The space at Al-Nadwa was half offices, half living quarters. All of us who lived or worked there had more than our share of daily exercise, climbing the 3 flights of stairs and picking up discarded clothes and toys along the way. We tried to maintain, or perhaps more accurately cling to, the feeling of an ordinary home. I wanted the children to feel natural and comfortable, even though we had to use the house for official gatherings as well. Distinguished guests, from Queen Elizabeth to the Sultan of Brunei, would sometimes pass by a jumble of tricycles, bicycles, and prams on their way to the front door. Al-Nadwa was considered quite a modest home for a king. It had no swimming pool, no tennis court, and unpretentious rooms. As one memorable headline in Paris Match put it, "The King of Kleenex lives better than the King of Jordan," referring to the fortunes of a leading local businessman living in the affluent new suburbs of the capital, Amman. But we treasured the gracious limestone building, which we considered a happy home. And I also valued our presence in the traditional heart of the capital and in close proximity to diverse groups of people. I loved the city's energy, the call to morning prayers, and the sound of animated voices on the streets down the hill from Al-Nadwa, and I did not mind the constant sound of traffic on the busy roads around the palace complex, or even the roar of planes taking off and landing at the nearby airport. The noise lessened somewhat when a new airport was built farther from Amman, but during the first years at Al-Nadwa, the scream of jet engines overhead was so loud we had to suspend our conversations or pause in the middle of a state banquet until the plane passed over. In this context, it is easy to understand why Hamza's first word was tayara, airplane. We lived as naturally as possible under the circumstances, but it was a challenge. I cut back on the household staff to gain some privacy, but still we required a manager, waiters, kitchen staff, and housekeepers to take care of the family and our many guests, from visiting heads of state to personal friends. I can scarcely remember a time when my husband and I were absolutely alone, without various family members, waiters setting up or removing meals, and office assistants or government officials with urgent business. We nonetheless made every effort to set aside time for the children in the evenings. Hussein and I often sat with them through their dinner, and then ate in our private sitting room while we helped them with homework or watched videos. We sometimes ordered out for food, usually falafel from a downtown Amman restaurant, as a special treat. But the fact was that the demands on our time were enormous, and we were being called upon constantly to solve the problems of our larger Jordanian family, often at the expense of time and focus on our own children. Even in the evenings, during what should have been inviolate family time, there were constant disruptions, phone calls, meetings, and emergencies. Al-Nadwa was only a few meters down the hill from the king's offices, so close that he never really felt he had left the office when he came home. I never begrudged these responsibilities, but I would often ask myself whether we could find a more successful formula for balancing our disparate commitments. Were we asking too much of all our children? It was a continuous struggle to coordinate our schedules to find time for meals and bedtime stories, even to be with the children when they were sick, but we did our best. And we had help. Although I did not want my children to be raised by other people, however loving, in the end it was a combined effort. It had to be. I like to think our children did have the advantage of growing up in an environment in which the concept of dedication to something larger than themselves was simply a part of life. Our family derived great pleasure from the innumerable animals that were given to us as gifts. Thanks to the generosity of visiting dignitaries, we had quite a menagerie in Jordan. The Algerian president presented us with a beautiful Barbary stallion, which I loved to ride. Unfortunately, the stallion was banished by my brother-in-law, Prince Hassan, after the horse kicked him when the Crown Prince rode up close to us on a polo pony when Hussein and I were out riding together one day. Then there were the gazelles my husband brought back from Yemen, which we kept, along with rabbits and chickens, in a little zoo we created at Al-Nadwa. And there were cats everywhere in Amman and Aqaba. My husband loved cats, as his grandfather had, and he felt he was maintaining a family tradition by allowing the garden around our home to serve as a refuge for strays. Perhaps the most unusual animal given to my husband was the lion from Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia. This happened well before I knew Hussein, but he loved to tell me the story of the lion's escape on the flight to Amman, and how it had terrorized the flight crew. It lived quite happily in Jordan, until it attacked and killed its keeper, and had to be put down. We had just as much of a menagerie inside the house, where hamsters and gerbils kept escaping from their cages. We could catch the children's guinea pigs because they were slower moving, but it was difficult to keep up with the hamsters. At one point we had a minor bird that managed to break loose from its carrying case during a plane ride home and bite my secretary as she chased it around the airplane cabin. Much to our frustration and puzzlement, the bird never talked. When it died, an autopsy revealed that the bird had chronic tonsillitis. Some pets caused us no end of trouble. When our fourth child, Raya, was around 4 years old, she was given a goat when we visited a Bedouin tribe in the desert. She fell in love with the animal, so there was nothing I could do but to bring it home with me in the car to Aqaba, where we built it a pen. The other children teased Raya by calling the goat Mansaf, the Jordanian national dish, usually prepared with lamb or goat. One day, Mansaf escaped from his pen and was eventually spotted on the beach well on his way to Israel. He was intercepted just before reaching the Israeli border guards. We had similar issues with Jazz, a black Labrador we were given by the Grand Duke and Grand Duchess of Luxembourg. The dog persisted in going into the sea at Aqaba and swimming straight toward the border with Israel. We came close to an international incident several times when Israeli gunboats came out to challenge Jazz. And my husband, who delighted in waiting until the very last minute, roared over in his boat so that the dog could be retrieved. After one state visit to Germany in the 1980s, as we were preparing to leave the guest house for the airport, I opened the door of our suite to find the housekeeper holding a basket with a German shepherd puppy in it. My husband joined me, looking rather sheepish. He claimed he had quite innocently mentioned his admiration for the breed to the German foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, at the official banquet the night before. We had already discussed the subject several times on our way to Germany, and I had told Hussein that I did not want another puppy at Al-Nadwa because living at the top of a four-story house with no elevator was enough of a climb for us, let alone for a puppy. We had already been through countless failures by then, including three Labrador retrievers, another German shepherd, a Saint Bernard, and even a panther Haya had been given. When I looked into the puppy's eyes, I relented, and for the next 6 months I carried him up and down the stairs. We named the shepherd Batal, which roughly translates to hero or tough guy in Arabic, and his short life was rather tragic. He was very intelligent, but he had a violent streak. 2 years later, despite our struggle to train him, which included professional help, there were still too many moments in the course of play when he would suddenly bare his fangs and turn into a terrifying, growling creature. He would attack cars coming into the driveway, sometimes puncturing their tires, and all of us had his teeth marks on our arms after we finished playing with him. We kept thinking it was our fault and that we were not handling him properly. Finally, we contacted the German training center where Batal had been bred to see if they could help. They recommended that we send him back for training. There, sadly, the breeders came to the conclusion that he was an outstanding dog, but an extremely aggressive alpha male, that 1 in 100 who could not be trained. They had to put Batal down, because there was no way to control him, and there was the distinct possibility that he would hurt someone. The children missed Batal, and Iman asked for a dog for her birthday. Soon after, I brought home a smaller, ostensibly more manageable dog, a beagle from England. This dog's story, which has a happy ending, includes one frightening chapter. I inadvertently ran over her one day when she ran between the front and rear wheels of my moving car. I felt my left rear tire hit a bump and heard someone screaming her name. I got out of the car, and there she was on the ground, looking quite flattened. I knelt down to comfort her, certain that she was drawing her last breath, when lo and behold, she slowly began to reinflate. It reminded me of the cartoons I would watch as a child, in which Daffy Duck would be run over by a steamroller and then pop back up. It turned out that our dog had suffered only a fractured hip, protected from worse harm because she was so rotund. My sister, who had dogs and no children at that point, was furious when she learned of the beagle's near demise. Alexa had decided long ago that we were unfit to have animals, and by the time I finished telling her the story, she was convinced the dog would not survive another minute in our house. "You send that dog over to me right away," she said. And so the beagle has lived with her ever since. And ever since then, I have been mercilessly teased for my caninecidal tendencies. At least the dogs we were being given were getting smaller. The last one was a 10-week-old Chihuahua, a gift from the former president of Mexico that my husband never warmed to. I eventually gave the dog to our German house manager, who had an apartment in Amman, and the tiny animal caused quite a stir on the streets. Dogs are nowhere near as common in Arab countries as they are in the West, and when Lisa took the Chihuahua, Señor Toki Ramirez, for walks, some people actually ran away in fright, and drivers braked to a halt and called out, "What is that?" My husband loved rescuing our runaway animals and all the general chaos of family life. He was a great tease, and I was a favorite target. He never tired of telling the story of a time early in our marriage, during a weekend in Aqaba, when I asked Manal Jazi, our Jordanian nanny, if she could find my camera. Manal was gone for the longest time, and, having misheard me, finally returned with a camel. My husband laughed uproariously, and the children, utterly delighted, spent the rest of the afternoon taking camel rides. Hussein personally supported the expenses of our home and of the extended royal family through financial resources he was given from within the Arab and Muslim world. He had a basic allowance from the government that had not changed in all his years as king, and neither of us took any personal money from the Jordanian government. In a crunch, he would sell his assets in order to cover royal court bills, which were largely devoted to health and education assistance, or to support institutions in need. Support from Arab and Muslim leaders who valued his stabilizing role within the region was critical in enabling the king to carry out his leadership responsibilities in Jordan, as well as his advocacy efforts for the region as a whole. Jordan was also reciprocating by contributing to the development of these countries through its expertise and manpower in areas such as education, health, medical research, and military training and security. However, support from the outside could not always be counted on. My husband handled his own finances in an open-handed, spontaneous way, based on his faith that God would provide. He believed that if he was a faithful Muslim, who focused more on the needs of others than on his own, God would enable him to continue his good works. This was not an MBA's approach to finance, but it could not have been. It was an ethical and humane balance that Hussein struck within the context of an environment that did not function like the West, that was constantly fluid and uncertain, and sometimes prone to extremes. The king would never turn away from someone in need. Many a morning he would listen to a local call-in show called Live Transmission and be stirred to offer assistance to someone in dire circumstances. At times his generosity seemed arbitrary, but like a traditional tribal leader, he often used it to maintain a complex political balance. In any event, the money went out as fast as it came in, and somehow it all worked out. My husband's security detail would have preferred us to move out of Al-Nadwa, as they were very concerned about its vulnerability. Despite the constant pressure to relocate to a more secure location, it would be 15 years before we managed it. Site after site that we liked, including beautiful land overlooking the Dead Sea that Sharif Nasser had given to us as an engagement present, would prove to have insurmountable security problems, lack of water, or some other problem. Or we would feel it was not the right moment financially. My husband felt an obligation to settle all the members of his family before himself, and we did not have the resources to do both simultaneously. At one point, after 10 years of working on countless architectural designs for houses that never came to fruition, I half-jokingly suggested, "Let's just live in a tent. If our forefathers were able to do it, why can't we? Think of all that fresh air and waking up in the morning with the sunrise." At least we could have chosen where we wanted our tent to be. The idyll would not have lasted long, however, since Hussein would have insisted on bringing along a noisy generator, as he did whenever we camped out. Until school intervened, we included the children in our working trips as much as possible. Iman was barely 4 months old and still nursing when we took her with us on an ambitious trip through Asia, to China, South Korea, Japan, and Malaysia, with a stopover first in Pakistan. The king wanted to solidify Far Eastern support for a Middle East peace initiative, and to encourage political, economic, and cultural cooperation. The Chinese ambassador to Jordan, who was helping to arrange our trip to his country, asked me what I would most like to see in China. I told him I had been working on plans for a children's hospital for Jordan for some time. The Arab Gulf state of Qatar had provided support for the planning phase, and I had secured a pledge of funds for the project from Iraq in 1981. After the Iran-Iraq war began to drag on and on, however, I decided it would be inappropriate to press Iraq for the funds. The project had been temporarily shelved, one more casualty of instability in the region. Still, I was making an effort to study pediatric facilities wherever we traveled in the world. The Chinese ambassador also asked if our delegation had any special needs his government should know about. My husband, knowing that I love Chinese food, had been teasing me about China's legendary hospitality, which included serving monkey brains and other exotic delicacies to their VIP guests. I decided to avoid the risk of offending our hosts by declaring in advance that I did not eat meat, that I was essentially vegetarian. Forevermore, Hussein would accuse me of gastronomic cowardice. As it turned out, we were not served anything as exotic as monkey brains in China, at least not so far as I know. However, one tradition our hosts did maintain involved serving extraordinary banquets of at least 10 courses. We marveled at the Chinese presentation of intricately carved fruits and vegetables, and at the quantity of a clear alcohol the Chinese consumed in a steady stream of toasts, not unlike the Russians with their vodka. At one banquet, the interpreter and I conspired to discreetly request that the little earthenware jug of alcohol at my place be filled with water instead, and I soon had a reputation for being able to keep pace with the increasingly jolly Chinese. The unfamiliar food, however, was a challenge for some members of our entourage. The second night in Beijing, several close members walked us, as usual, to the door of our bedroom to bid us good night. As we entered, they stepped inside behind us, which was decidedly unusual. After a moment, it dawned on me that they had heard about my habit of bringing extra food on trips. So I pulled out the plastic containers of date brownies and granola bars I had brought from Amman as emergency supplies. That night, and for many to come, we sat up late together, reviewing the day's events and sharing our impressions of that vast and majestic country and its outgoing, resourceful people. I carried Iman in a backpack along the Great Wall of China to see the ancient terracotta horses in Xi'an, and on a boat trip down the Yangtze River to Guilin. At the Children's Hospital in Beijing, I was fascinated to learn about the medical use of acupuncture as anesthesia for even major operations. Traditional herbal remedies were available in Jordan, and Hussein and I had benefited from acupuncture therapy, but this use of acupuncture was a revelation, and I thought it might hold great promise for our medical community. Overall, our trip to China was a great success, producing an accord on trade and technological cooperation, as well as an interest-free loan and a pledge of support for King Hussein's initiatives toward peace with Israel. South Korea was far more troubling to me than Communist China. I was quite unsettled by Korea's militaristic atmosphere and the centralized state control, which reminded me of my first visits to Syria and Iraq in the 1970s, before I married. The huge security presence could be felt everywhere, particularly in the city centers and near universities. Everyone we spoke to was exceedingly careful not to discuss government policy. During a visit to a Korean charity, I was struck by the polished presentation of their work, more like a public relations campaign extolling the virtues of the regime than a genuine development enterprise. Hussein, on the other hand, was riveted by his visits to the Korean military installations, especially our trip to the demilitarized zone, where he and I were briefed on South Korean military readiness. Our hosts pointed out vast expanses of minefields they claimed were an essential line of defense against the enemy. The United States has long used South Korea's security needs as justification for not signing the Ottawa Landmine Ban Treaty. At the time, little attention seemed to be paid to the human tragedy caused by the rigidly controlled border between the two Koreas, although I heard heartbreaking stories from Korean families separated for a lifetime from their relatives across the border. Like so many Palestinian families in our area, Korean families were desperate to reunite, but could not because of the political situation. We then continued on to Japan, which, like South Korea, imported 70% of its oil from the Middle East, and, also like South Korea, was very supportive of the Arab position in general. It was my husband's second trip to Japan in 9 months. He had earlier led an Arab League delegation to Tokyo to explain the Arab peace plan. We were warmly received. I was particularly touched by our meeting with Emperor Hirohito. I was well aware of the controversy surrounding his role in the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, some claiming he had been powerless to prevent it, others claiming he was the master planner of the attack. Whatever the truth, the man I met 42 years later was a sweet 82-year-old man who was not in the best of health. Nonetheless, knowing of my background in architecture and planning, he insisted on walking me through the huge imperial palace in Tokyo, pointing out design details and the beautiful ornamentation and artwork. I was moved by the effort this required, since he had difficulty walking. Their son, Crown Prince Akihito, and his wife Princess Michiko, who became Emperor and Empress on Emperor Hirohito's death in 1989, were also utterly charming and hospitable. We visited them at their home, where I was immediately struck by an alcove in the entrance to their private sitting area that housed a piano and several music stands. It turned out that every family member played an instrument, and they often played together. I thought how wonderful it would be if we could get all the members of our family to play music together. Hamza and Hashim did take up the violin with our National Music Conservatory. But before any talent became apparent, lack of family support, even from their father, dampened their enthusiasm. The Crown Prince and his wife were a kind and loving couple. She was gentle and serene, a published author and poet. The Crown Prince had inherited his father's passion for marine biology. When I returned to Japan with my son Hashim some years later to open an exhibition on Jordan, the Crown Prince, knowing of Hashim's interest in marine life, presented him with two magnificent volumes of his work in the field, books that my son treasures to this day. When we returned to Jordan, Hussein redoubled his efforts to jumpstart the stalled peace process before it was too late. Settlement creep was continuing unchecked on the occupied West Bank, with new enclaves surrounded by barbed wire and guarded by troops, effectively and constantly enlarging Israel's military perimeter. Lest we doubt Israel's military superiority, Israeli reconnaissance planes swept over our side of the Jordan River every morning, leaving shattering sonic booms in their wake as a form of intimidation. The Israeli Air Force also regularly conducted mock dogfights in Jordanian airspace over the farms in the Jordan River Valley, which terrified the animals and sharply diminished their output of eggs and milk. The farmers claimed they could set their watches by the regularity of the Israeli maneuvers, and it was even possible to hear them miles away in the capital. During this period of rising tensions in the fall of 1983, we received foreign visitors in quick succession. Former President Carter and Mrs. Carter, German Chancellor Helmut Kohl and his wife Hannelore, a state visit from French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing and his wife Anne Aymon, and an official visit from Italian President Sandro Pertini. Given all the problems we were facing, it was difficult to appear serene and carefree with our guests. Hussein was better at it than I, having developed the ability to appear fully connected to the world immediately around him when he was, in fact, focused on something else. The visit from President Pertini proved quite amusing. A delightful, extravagantly flirtatious older man, Pertini was unaware, or unconcerned, that Jordan's conservative, male-dominated court was not accustomed to my being the object of lavish attention. President Pertini did not do anything outrageous. He just flattered me by making me the focal point of his remarks. My husband accepted this banter with amusement, unlike certain members of the Diwan who thought the center of attention should always be the king. The Duke of Edinburgh arrived from Great Britain in October 1983 in his capacity as president of the World Wildlife Fund. To Hussein's great pride, and mine, the Royal Society for the Conservation of Nature, RSCN, was about to reintroduce the endangered Arabian oryx into the wild. For conservationists, it was a long-awaited moment of extraordinary significance. A medium-sized white antelope with black patches on its face, dark legs, and two long, curving horns, the oryx once thrived in Jordan and the semi-desert environments of other Middle Eastern countries. By 1962, when an international commission was formed to save this animal from extinction, its numbers had dwindled to fewer than 20. A small herd of the graceful oryx was successfully bred in captivity at the Phoenix, Arizona Zoo in the United States, and in 1978, Jordan became the first country to be entrusted with 8 of these rare animals, which were kept at a reserve in eastern Jordan. Hussein and I had closely followed their progress and were thrilled when the herd, augmented by a gift from Qatar, grew to 31, a number considered sufficient for release. The fencing around the protected area into which the oryx were to be released had been donated by Sultan Qaboos of Oman, himself an avid environmentalist. This cooperative effort culminated in the release of the oryx on October 18, 1983. My husband and Prince Philip did the honors, opening the pens as the elegant creatures emerged into their new habitat, a moment that was recorded in the Guinness Book of World Records. Nearly 20 years later, the herd has grown to more than 140, and the program has been extended to include other endangered species, such as the ostrich, the onager, and the Nubian ibex. The rescue of the Arabian oryx from near extinction was one of the great environmental success stories of the time, and it provided a blueprint for cooperation among the Arab states and with such international environmental organizations as the World Wildlife Fund. Prince Philip would later invite me to succeed him as president of WWF, the largest privately supported international conservation organization in the world, dedicated to protecting the world's wildlife and wildlands. I considered this offer an enormous honor, but the timing was wrong for me to assume that degree of responsibility. Instead, I have served with pride as a member of the board. These successes were not without opposition. Environmentalists everywhere have to fight against short-term interests, and in Jordan the clash was particularly acute because both arable land and water were in short supply. One classic example involved a confrontation with a government minister shortly after the government created a reserve in Wadi Mujib, the lowest elevation nature reserve on the planet, a spectacular stretch of land along the Dead Sea that rises dramatically from far below sea level to the peaks of the eastern highlands. By law, nobody could do anything within the reserve without the consent of the RSCN, which had charge of its management. But this particular minister was from the area and was successfully pressured to open the Wadi Mujib Reserve for grazing. The first I heard about it was from the president of the RSCN, our friend Anis Mouasher. The warden in Wadi Mujib had called Anis to report that two bulldozers had entered the reserve to open roads and plant crops. They were under orders from the minister, the men told him. Anis instructed the warden to step in front of the bulldozers to block them, and told the minister in question that the decision to make Wadi Mujib a protected reserve had been a high-level cabinet decision, and that he would have to appeal to the cabinet to reverse that decision. In response, the minister arrested the warden and put him in jail. Hussein and I were having a late dinner in Aqaba with King Juan Carlos and Queen Sophie and a few other friends, including Anis, when we received word of the warden's arrest. Normally I would not have disturbed the king at a time like this, but I knew he would appreciate the urgency of the situation. In fact, he was furious. He put down his napkin and briefly excused himself from the table. 15 minutes later, Anis was called to the phone by no less a ranking official than the National Director of Public Security. "What is going on?" Anis was asked. "His Majesty is very angry. He has just woken me and the Chief of Staff of the Army and told us to call you." So Anis explained the situation, and within hours the bulldozers were out of the Wadi Mujib Reserve, and our warden had been released. Protecting the environment required constant vigilance, and this time we had been lucky. My husband loved the natural world. In addition to his beloved Jordan, he had a special attachment to the English countryside, dating back, I imagine, to his first sight of England as a young student, fresh from the arid climes of Jordan and Egypt. I shall never forget a brief visit we made to Martha's Vineyard, off the coast of Massachusetts. We had just attended Prince Faisal's graduation from Brown University, from which we made the short trip to the site of my father's vacation dream house. As my father proudly showed us his little piece of paradise, Hussein looked at the scrub brush and beech plum all around, muttering to me about how the scraggly vegetation contrasted pathetically to the grandeur and nobility of the English landscape. Jordan's forests were a key focus for the king's conservation efforts. During his reign, Hussein more than doubled the size of Jordan's forests with a national reforestation program, which we participated in each year. The hope, of course, was that the example set by the royal family would be a strong motivator in Jordan. Sometimes this was far less enjoyable than planting trees. On a number of occasions, I took Haya, Ali, and Hamza with me to pick up litter in Amman's public parks, and I was always so proud of them for contributing without complaint. The RSCN also organized field trips for schoolchildren to Jordan Valley Farms, during which we cleared fields of litter and plastic refuse, which are so dangerous to livestock. Pollution in Aqaba was also a concern. Phosphate was one of our major exports, and the loading of container ships in Aqaba's port was unleashing huge amounts of dust into the air. Not only was it a waste of phosphate, but also the dust was causing a high incidence of respiratory problems in Aqaba. Company officials repeatedly promised us corrective action, but it took many years before the problem was brought under control. We did succeed much more quickly in passing a strict maritime law prohibiting the dumping of waste in the port area. To enforce it, the King donated a boat to the RSCN to monitor the harbor. The resulting significant fines on miscreant tankers gave Jordan an uncompromising reputation in the shipping industry, which took far greater care thereafter to avoid discharging wastes into our waters. Hussein loved the sea. While in Aqaba, he personally instructed all of his children in water skiing as they reached the appropriate age or degree of fearlessness. I remember a tiny Ali insisting on trying, and he set the mark for the youngest to do so, in spite of being totally submerged under salty spray as he made his round. My husband also managed to get me onto the skis, despite my aversion to the sport, acquired from an excruciating childhood failure on a freshwater lake in Michigan. By contrast, the high salinity of the Red Sea provides maximum buoyancy, and is therefore ideal for water skiing and swimming, even for the reluctant. The greatest pleasure for all of us who loved him was Hussein's obvious delight in day-long fishing trips along our coastline, past our border with Saudi Arabia, across the Gulf from the Israeli city of Eilat and the Egyptian coastline, and farther down the Gulf of Aqaba. He would captain the boat, sometimes going up on the foredeck to smoke his pipe and meditate for hours, stopping if the excited shouts of children signaled a fish strike, usually tuna. We would return at sunset. Those close to Hussein were used to these bouts of deep contemplation and knew not to disturb him. Ibrahim Izzeddin once described the look on the king's face during those periods as the same expression that Hussein assumed when at prayer. These days, the calm Hussein sought did not come so easily. I tried to help him as best I could, mostly by being available when he wanted to talk, but for the most part he kept his own counsel. In this stalemate of no peace, no war, he began to have trouble sleeping. "Their suffering is becoming intolerable," he told me, referring to the Palestinians. So, I thought, was his. He seemed lost in thought half the time, and had started smoking heavily again. He also had an episode of arrhythmia, a condition he had lived with since the 1970s, which required him to take anticoagulants to thin his blood. While his arrhythmia was not life-threatening, the medication was. It nearly killed him in January 1984. I was in Aqaba with official guests waiting for Hussein to join us from Amman when I received an emergency phone call informing me that my husband was critically ill. I immediately flew back to Amman to find that Hussein had very nearly bled to death. He had been walking from the Diwan to Al-Nadwa with his brother, Crown Prince Hassan, when he had suddenly developed a nosebleed. Because of the anticoagulants, the nosebleed had quickly turned into a full-blown hemorrhage. His doctor arrived quickly, but Hussein's face was already the color of chalk. When he lost consciousness, the palace physician could find no pulse. My husband was, for all intent and purposes, dead. He was stable when I arrived, having been revived after receiving several transfusions. "I felt no pain, no fear, no worries," he said to me later. "I was a free spirit, floating above my own body. It was rather a pleasant feeling, really." He described what is frequently referred to as a near-death experience. He saw a bright light, felt relaxed, and realized he was going. "I must get back," he kept telling himself. "I must get back." and with the immediate medical care he received, he did. The doctors cut back on the anticoagulants, and Hussein never had another episode like that again. The stress and tension the king had always lived with had taken a definite toll on his body. Shortly after that critical episode in Amman, we went to a clinic in Cleveland, Ohio, where he underwent an intensive physical examination. The doctors there were blunt. After testing all his internal organs, including his heart, they told him, "You have to assume you are 10 years older than you are." From then on, my husband lived with a keener sense of his own mortality. We went to Washington, D.C., following the checkup at the Cleveland Clinic, for a historic moment, King Hussein's first public meeting with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak since the Camp David Accords, and the first step in the Arab world's rapprochement with Egypt. The arrangements were being made by our ambassador to the United Nations and the Egyptian ambassador, who was his good friend. Both of them wanted the meeting to take place at a public banquet, but Hussein and I preferred to begin with a quiet dinner alone with President and Mrs. Mubarak, given all the years of enforced silence. Egypt's relations with the Arab world were still extremely tense and fractured, making the king's decision to break the Arab boycott of Egypt bold and courageous, even dangerous. However, he understood that Jordan's best interests, as well as those of each country in the region, depended upon the degree of unity and cooperation that might be nurtured among them. News of the meeting sent a strong signal to the Arab world that Jordan, at least, thought it was time to end Egypt's isolation. King Hussein would formalize Jordan's reconciliation with Egypt in the fall of 1984, and for the next 3 years, he would lobby throughout the Arab world to repair relations with Egypt. The Mubaraks became frequent visitors to Jordan after that. In October 1984, we hosted a state banquet for them in Amman. In the course of the dinner, the president spoke to me at length, sharing his concerns about the high profile Mrs. Sadat had assumed as First Lady, and his conviction that it had been inappropriate and counterproductive. He was emphatic that his wife, Suzanne, would assume a much lower profile. He was so emphatic that I guessed he may have been commenting on my own increasingly outspoken role in the areas of Arab-Western relations and national issues. His was a typical traditional perspective. Nonetheless, over the years, Suzanne wisely and adeptly assumed a prominent position in her work to promote literacy and a library culture in Egypt, as well as other issues. Throughout the 1980s, I undertook several intensive speaking tours in America, grueling 2-week marathons of speeches, interviews, incessant drafting and redrafting of remarks late into each night, struggling with the draining combination of my perfectionism and the often bewildering complexities of our region's politics, to try to achieve a constructive and meaningful assessment of U.S.-Arab relations and policy. Many in the region and in the United States were insisting that I could add a unique voice and perspective from the region for American audiences, in particular because they could identify with me. Only for those reasons was I willing to leave Hussein and the children for such long periods of time. Often I shared our parental responsibilities by taking our youngest, Iman, with me. Reading over those early speeches now, I smile. I was only too conscious of being the youngest person at these gatherings addressing issues of such political importance. As a result, the speeches were quite dry, the result of my work with academics and experts in Jordan to ensure their accuracy above all else. Only after years of experience and a growing sense that I had established some credibility would I begin to personalize my presentations. I was not naive enough to think my speeches could change policy or have a decisive effect on public opinion, but I was tremendously encouraged and motivated by the audience's response. The American media offered few perspectives on the Middle East other than that of Israel. American audiences and some decision-makers had limited ways of learning about the region, and that was what I was attempting to offer. My speech-writing ordeals were considerably eased in the 1980s when my stepson, Prince Abdullah, returned from a visit to Taiwan with a very generous gift of a laptop computer. I was delighted by his thoughtfulness, but fairly certain that I would never find the time to learn to use it, remembering my struggles in high school to master the impenetrable BASIC and Fortran languages of the MIT computer we were connected to at Concord Academy. However, thanks to my extremely patient secretary, I quickly became completely dependent on the machine for all my speech work and data storage. That laptop became an indispensable mobile office, to which I became completely wedded until it literally fell apart years later and had to be replaced. Just as I was readying myself to address the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on March 15, someone handed me an interview my husband had given that morning to the New York Times. The U.S. is not free to move except within the limits of AIPAC and what the Zionists and the State of Israel determine for it, King Hussein had said as part of an interview enumerating issues of concern. Leila Sharaf, who was traveling with me, groaned when she read the interview. We wondered if we should tone down my speech, but decided to go ahead as planned, and encountered no problems with the question-and-answer session after my remarks. Perhaps in California they had not read that morning's Times. They certainly had in Washington, where I attended an Arab-American event to support Lebanon a few days later. I was startled when President Reagan's National Security Advisor, Robert McFarlane, suddenly materialized and asked to speak with me. He sat down, leaned very close, and asked, "Are you trying to lose the president the election?" I was dumbfounded. "No," I replied. "We would never seek to influence your elections. But we do want you to know that Palestinian and Lebanese civilians are dying every day, and we cannot ignore that for the duration of your political campaigns." McFarlane, no doubt reflecting the administration's perspective, was preoccupied with one interest alone: the re-election of the president. Our exchange underscored a danger inherent in the American political system. For all its considerable merits and inspirational principles, the American system is based upon a continuous, uninterrupted process of election campaigns stretching out year after year. Lost in the perpetual scramble is any long-term vision capable of addressing the complex tangle of causes at the root of human suffering, especially in the Middle East. It was on the long flight back to Jordan in 1984 that I decided to make fundamental changes in the protocol of my travel. The Royal Court always booked me into the presidential or royal suites in all the best hotels, and provided enormous limousines, in keeping with the traditional view equating status with luxury. I was candid about my view that such extravagant arrangements were unnecessary and inappropriate. One suite, booked for me in New York, had a living room the size of a ballroom. "I am concerned that we are sending the wrong signal when we are spending so much money," I told the chief of protocol. I cut back on the staff that traveled with me, and also insisted on flying commercially overseas. On that first speaking tour to America, I had been flown to the United States and back in one of our commercial aircraft that had been refitted with a sleeping area and low-density seating. It was supremely comfortable, but once I calculated the fuel costs and other expenses, I said, "Never again." I arrived back from the speaking tour just in time for a 5-day state visit by Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip. My husband, in anticipation of the Queen's visit, abandoned his resolve to give up smoking. This was to be Queen Elizabeth's first trip to Jordan during the 32 years that she and Hussein had been on their respective thrones, and it was put in jeopardy at the last minute by an explosion in the parking lot of Amman's Intercontinental Hotel. The Queen gamely ignored calls from the British press to cancel the trip and arrived in Amman with Prince Philip on March 27. Since Queen Elizabeth could travel only with her own crew in her own aircraft, Hussein drove us all to Petra from Aqaba, rather than, as was his custom, helicoptering the royal couple, which would have provided them with breathtaking bird's-eye views of Wadi Rum and Petra. For all the official trips Western leaders and European royals made to Jordan, my husband was in much closer and more regular contact with Middle Eastern and Muslim leaders. Many became good friends, including Sultan Hassan al-Bolkiah of Brunei, who made a state visit to Jordan at the end of 1984. The Sultan, a very soft-spoken, kind man, had a natural affinity with Hussein. They were both devout Muslims who shared lofty aspirations for their respective countries. They also shared a love of aviation. Brunei is tucked away on the northwestern coast of Borneo, and the Sultan frequently traveled long distances to connect his country to the rest of the world. On occasion, Hussein advised him on aviation matters. At the time of the Sultan's state visit, Brunei had just declared its independence from Britain, and my husband was being as helpful as he could be during the period of transition. Brunei, of course, had a tremendous advantage in achieving its goals. Thanks to rich oil and gas reserves, its population enjoys one of the highest per capita incomes in the world. The Sultan was very supportive of my husband, and would even buy his London home in the early 1990s, enabling Hussein to finance the restoration and regilding of the Al-Aqsa, or Dome of the Rock, mosque in Jerusalem. We would make a visit to Brunei ourselves in 1986. The Sultan had two wives, which is acceptable in Islam so long as both wives are treated absolutely equally. He had built two palaces for his wives and their children, one of which, Istana, is the seat of government and sits on 300 acres of beautifully landscaped grounds just above the capital, Bandar Seri Begawan. It has rooms the size of a football field for state functions, and its banquet hall can accommodate 5,000 guests under long double rows of gold and crystal chandeliers. The Sultan of Brunei would also visit us in England, and on one memorable occasion, he vanished. I will never forget the consternation of his security guards as they furiously searched for the Sultan, joined by our own security who were scouring the grounds for my husband. It turned out that my husband's pilot in England, Richard Verrill, had arrived at the house in a helicopter that was a recent gift to my husband. As Richard was showing it to Hussein, the Sultan climbed into the captain's seat next to Richard, and my husband climbed into the seat behind, and off they flew without telling anyone. The three pilots sat down in a nearby airfield where they practiced hovering and landing on sloping ground and small clearings. They returned an hour later, like guilty boys, to face their furious security details. My husband apologized profusely, but it was clear to everyone that he and the Sultan had had a very good time. Since the early 1970s, Hussein had been particularly close to Sultan Qaboos of Oman, who was as generous as he was enlightened. We had first visited his country together shortly after we married, and had observed firsthand the extraordinary progress the young Sultan had made in the first few years of his reign. His father, Sultan Said, had kept Oman virtually shut off from the rest of the world. Although plentiful reserves of oil had been discovered in Oman during Sultan Said's reign, the eccentric leader had refused to spend any income on developing the infrastructure of the country or on its people. When his son, Qaboos, returned to Oman after studying at Sandhurst, his father kept him under house arrest for the next 6 years. It was not until 1970 that Qaboos took power by overthrowing his father in a bloodless coup and sending him into exile. Qaboos immediately set about building roads, expanding irrigation, and providing housing and electricity to his people. He also opened up Oman to new ideas and culture, by creating free primary and secondary schools, and establishing Sultan Qaboos University, a particularly impressive institution of higher learning. What endeared me to the Sultan, beyond his investment in his own people, was his appreciation and support for the environment, culture, and the arts. When I think of Oman now, I think of music. On our first visit, Sultan Qaboos had just installed a new pipe organ in his palace and was taking lessons from an organ master. The Sultan loved music and in the evenings we were serenaded, sometimes until dawn, by live performances of the Royal Oman Symphony Orchestra. The Sultan's mother, Qaboos, whom I had met in London on my honeymoon, was an extraordinary example of the very influential role many women play in the Arab world, the Gulf in particular. The role is not public, so many people outside the region do not realize how important it really is. She was invaluable to her son as a link to many groups in Oman society, and to ruling families in the Gulf. I liked her very much, and carefully considered what gifts I could bring her and her son from Jordan, because they were always so generous to us. And we were greatly indebted to Sultan Qaboos himself for his support to my husband and to Jordan. His generosity sometimes weighed on my husband, who felt he could not adequately reciprocate. While the king and I occasionally traveled to some Gulf countries together, for the most part official visits were exchanged only between leaders. Women visited for personal occasions, such as weddings. These were often lavish 3-day affairs during which the sexes were segregated. The festivities would start late, and long evenings would extend into mourning. In vast halls, hundreds of women of all ages would turn out in magnificent couture creations. Even infants were adorned with dazzling jewels. Occasionally, things got out of hand. There was a terrifying moment at one Gulf wedding, during an evening performance for the women guests, when several members of the groom's party appeared on stage, waving semi-automatic weapons in the traditional form of celebration. I was seated directly in front of the stage with the wives of other Arab leaders and dignitaries, and could think only of the headlines in the newspapers if the revelers accidentally shot us all. Mercifully, they chose to lurch back off the stage and out of the tent. One of the most colorful weddings I ever attended was the celebration for one of King Hassan II's daughters in Morocco. In honor of his daughter's marriage, King Hassan had offered free weddings to 400 local young women. The king himself orchestrated the entire event. He was the only man present, and dressed in a dapper white suit, attended to even the smallest details, signaling for the lights to be dimmed, the music to begin, and the food to be served. And what a spectacle it was! The city of Marrakesh was completely closed for the wedding festivities. Its streets were lined with exquisite Arabian stallions, with riders in traditional Berber garb, and thronged with a sea of well-wishers and entertainers. A completely different style of wedding took place in Jordan in 1985, when Damien Elwes, the son of our English friend Tessa Kennedy, was married in the Church of Moses on Mount Nebo. The beautiful 4th-century church, from which the Pope would begin his pilgrimage to the Holy Land in 2000, is perched high above the Dead Sea with a breathtaking panoramic view. A deep sense of spirituality pervades the partially restored church and its exquisite 6th-century mosaics. Antique rugs had been laid on the floor of the church along with a few chairs, but that was all. The structure itself was more than enough. As the ceremony ended, white doves were released to soar free over the River Jordan. My husband and I saw the flashes of white as we flew in by helicopter to pick up the bridal party and take them on to Aqaba, where the couple would spend their wedding night cruising up the Red Sea on a boat. It was a perfect day. Walking back to the helicopter on Mount Nebo, I watched one of the white doves settle on a rotor blade. I saw it as a good omen, a blessing on my husband, the determined peacemaker. Chapter 12. Women Hold Up Half the Sky. In February 1985, after several months of intense negotiations between Jordanian and PLO officials, Yasser Arafat and his colleagues secretly agreed to accept Resolution 242 and the withdrawal of Israel to its 1967 boundaries as the basis for peace negotiations. And with that acceptance came implicit recognition of Israel's right to exist. In return, Arafat wanted enforcement of UN Resolution 181 which called for the partition of British-ruled Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. Among other demands, he also called for an international conference of all parties involved under the auspices of the UN Security Council. The following month, the King and I returned to America on a state visit, and Hussein told President Reagan about the secret agreement with Arafat. Reagan was heartened to hear about the breakthrough, and the two leaders even laid out a timetable leading up to the international conference, which was to be held in November. What seemed so promising, however, quickly began to unravel. Before our trip to Washington, D.C., Arafat had reiterated his promise to accept Resolution 242 to our Prime Minister, Zayd Rifai. But almost immediately upon our return to Jordan, the PLO chairman began putting more and more conditions on making the acceptance official and public. My husband's frustration with Arafat was soon eclipsed by news from Washington. Because neither the United States nor Israel would talk with the PLO, my husband and Arafat had sent Washington a secret list of more moderate Palestinians who could serve as potential delegates to the conference. The Reagan administration immediately leaked the list to Israel, where the secret list became very public the next day, and the names were announced and rejected by Shimon Peres, the Israeli Prime Minister, in the Knesset. Things went downhill from there. The United States began to balk at proceeding with the international conference. Hardliners in the PLO began to balk at Arafat's initiative. My husband redoubled his efforts, and with Arafat sent a joint